Welcome to Under the Fig Tree podcast. In today's episode, hosts Reverend Micah Glenn and Reverend Dr. Ben Haupt sit down with a special guest as they meditate under the fig tree.
What's up? Welcome back to another episode of Under the Fig Tree. Ben, how are you doing on this almost spring day?
I'm good. You kind of caught me off guard because you didn't say that you were Reverend Micah Glenn.
And I am.
I know that you have decided that we don't need to do that, introduce ourselves to our listeners every single episode. So, good.
I also good usually intro. Call you Reverend Dr. Ben Haupt.
Right.
The right, very Reverend Dr. Ben Haupt.
I'm good. Things are all right. Yeah. It's spring and it's getting beautiful. It's nice to see some sunshine. Some warmer weather. Yeah, things are good.
It is something I never take for granted. Season changes around here are remarkable.
Yeah.
From summer to fall, and then from winter to spring, you just couldn't ask for anything better. Things are beginning to bloom, and my allergies suffer, but soon the cherry blossoms will be out. You take that walk down the path in Concordia Park, and you just admire God's creation. It's great.
Yeah.
Well, we are joined by our guest, whom I will introduce properly, Reverend Dr. Jerry Bodie. Mm-hmm. I was going to call you by your government name, but everybody just calls you Jerry.
That's right. You can call me Jerry.
There we go. How are you doing today?
I'm fine. I'm doing well. Thank you. Thanks for having me.
No, welcome to the podcast. I just realized that this is the first time we've been able to have you on, which is a treat. You're on our... We have a list of people that we ask and, you know... Everybody's busy these days, right? And we record at specific times. And so you've been on our list for a long time. And so, yeah, it's a treat to finally have you on.
It's great. Great to be here with you guys. I've been watching your podcast with other people thinking, maybe I'll get to do that someday.
Well, for sure. Well, and then, you know, we started off, and I tell people this, and it's very genuine. When we first started doing a podcast, A, we weren't very good at podcasting.
That is true.
B, we didn't have as much support, and so it was kind of up to me and Ben, namely me, of like producing the podcast, scheduling guests, and that's just not a gift. And so we would do like these like 15 episode runs, and then we take a break. And then we do another 15 episode run, and then we took a break, and then we were like, okay.
And then we took a really long break.
A very long break. And then we said, okay, if we're going to do Under the Fig Tree, and we were getting feedback, people kept telling us, when are you going to come back out with it? When are you going to come back out with it? And we had this big dream of having it not just on audio, but also visual. And our listeners have heard this, and here we are. But the point is that we're getting more and more support. And hopefully somebody will eventually kind of fully produce it for us and schedule guests. And we'll have like stars next to people that we want to have back regularly. So you haven't not been on because we haven't not wanted you on. It's just been when you have me and Ben doing the scheduling. It's wishy-washy at best.
We're doing our best.
I was talking to somebody else about this on our team, and they were asking me about planning something for somebody. I was like, listen, planning something for the congregation that I serve as interim pastor. And I was like, you know, in my 9-to-5 job, I was like, when it comes to scheduling and booking things, I was like, the people on my team don't let me because it won't happen. So if you guys want something done here, put it on a calendar that I see. And if you want me there, just tag me. And if I'm available, I'll show up. Mm-hmm. Otherwise, you'll be waiting forever. So.
Yeah, so it's really good to have you on. You teach history here at Concordia Seminary. And that's one of the four disciplines of the seminary, especially for all of our programs, I think pretty much every program has a course in at least one of each of the four disciplines. And so you teach historical courses. I know that you studied the catechism for your dissertation, and now you primarily teach more in a little bit later period of history, usually the kind of 19th and 20th, early 20th centuries. I guess all of the 20th century is now history.
So right.
it's all fair game for Dr. Bodie.
Yeah, it is. Yesterday was history, you know, so we can go back just a little bit. But I teach mostly in the area of of modern history, I suppose, Reformation to the present.
Yeah.
And I do teach other classes here and there, but mostly in the history of the Lutheran Reformation, other Reformation movements in the 16th or 17th century. And even beyond that as well, just in January, I taught a course during the Winterim. It was a short course, just 1 week, on the history of Lutheranism during the era of Orthodoxy. So this was more of a 17th century.
Okay.
It's the first time I'd ever taught that, and it was a lot of fun. Got to read texts that we hadn't read before and explore some new things. So I kind of work more, you know, from the Reformation into later areas, but I also teach quite a bit in the area of American Lutheranism, history of the Lutheran Church Missouri Synod, things like that.
I've heard of that place, that group of people, strange group of people sometimes, but God love us.
Mm-hmm. Jesus died for us too, that's what I tell people all the time.
And you're a fantastic storyteller. I'm really excited to have you on the podcast just to hear you tell stories, because when Jerry Bode tells stories about the history of the Lutheran Church Missouri Synod, all of a sudden you feel like you're there, and there's all of a sudden you can tell the person's personality, and it's just a lot of fun. So I'm really looking forward to talking a little bit about the history of our church body, and because it's actually so interesting. In some ways, it's so relevant. In some ways, history is so different. But both of those aspects of history are really, really interesting for us and how we're living in our world today. Mm-hmm. But we want to start with your own history. How about that for a pivot? to ask about your own history of becoming a pastor. Before you became a seminary professor, you went to seminary, you got your Master's of Divinity to become a pastor in the Lutheran Church Missouri Synod. So take us all the way back to the Little Jerry days.
And, that's what they called me, actually, Little Jerry.
Little Jerry.
Yeah, because my dad was Big Jerry. He had the same name I do. He's actually Gerhard, which is my name as well. My grandfather was Gerhard.
Okay.
And so
it's a good stout German Lutheran name.
Yeah, it's a durable, German name, and I grew up with my dad as a pastor. Before that, he had been a teacher, a Lutheran school teacher. Mm. In fact, his father had been a Lutheran school teacher, and then later a pastor. And his father had been a Lutheran school teacher. So this goes back generations of teaching and being pastors in the church. So I didn't really have to think very hard about what I wanted to do when I was a kid, because I got to see my dad working as a pastor, serving as a pastor, which was really a wonderful thing. He's retired now, but he's probably preaching this weekend. He still is. But he was a very, very good role model for me in so many different ways. And I think that watching him for all those years growing up in a parsonage really had an impact on me. I grew up in southern Minnesota. I was born in Waconia in Carver County, which is a heavily German Lutheran county just west of the Twin Cities. We have a number of students here from Carver County that, guys, I went to the same school I did, and so there's still have a lot of guys that come from southern Minnesota to the seminary. But I was one of those guys, and I watched my dad work as a pastor and a teacher and a preacher and one who served people in so many different ways in our congregation in Wayzata, where I grew up, which is on the west side of Minneapolis. And it was I don't want to sound effusive too much, but it was a wonderful place, a wonderful experience. And it was thoroughly enjoyable as a kid. And
did your dad ever have to call you out in a sermon and say, "Jerry, little Jerry, sit down, stop talking to your"?
There's probably a rule about that in preaching class. Don't talk about your kids.
But I know that a lot of preachers break that rule. Yeah, we've heard some stories already.
Yeah, my dad was pretty good about that. Yeah, I mean, cool. if we did something amusing or funny, which we often tried to do, it might show up, but. we might be in the Christmas newsletter. That might be where he would bring it in. But he was the whole experience was so positive to me. Wow. Not simply because I saw him. He worked really hard. This is a difficult thing. He was serving as a pastor and you know always busy, but he thoroughly enjoyed his work. And it's amazing to me how even my dad even in his retirement, will still often when we get together and talk on the phone, he'll often want to talk about preaching, or he'll tell me if he's preaching next Sunday or something like that. He'll tell me about the sermon that he's working on.
Yeah, yeah.
He loves it, absolutely loves it, and he loved it when he was a younger man too. And it was kind of infectious because you realize this guy loves what he's doing. Especially when in Bible class or in preaching, to get to spend time studying God's Word and then telling other people about what you find in the Scriptures is one of the most amazing things in the whole world.
Wow.
And I found that was part of the reason why I wanted to be a pastor, because it was ultimately God's Word and the content of the Scriptures that made me want to do this. It wasn't simply watching my dad and having his influence, but it was the Bible and the story of God's love for us in the Bible, in Christ, that drove me, if you will, compelled me to want to do this. And but I do want to say along the way that the congregation that we were in, Redeemer Lutheran Church in Wayzata, was a wonderful congregation with great people who were dedicated and hardworking, who really cared about the church. And that made me want to be a pastor. Mm. I want to work with a congregation and with people who are actively engaged in the life of the church and who care about it and want to tell others about the church. The congregation was very interested in outreach and evangelism, very interested in mission work. We were always big supporters of mission work. And all of that together just really gave me a very positive experience. I went to Lutheran schools, Lutheran high school, and that impacted me as well. I had some really great teachers in school that really encouraged me to want to do this. And some of those high school teachers or elementary school teachers, I still remember things they told me to this day that have impacted me, and that I think differently about things because of that influence that I have. That's one thing that I've always been so grateful for, whether it be in elementary school or high school or college or certainly here at the seminary. I had some great teachers who encouraged me and inspired me to do things, and that's something that I hope in at least some small way that I can contribute to here at the seminary is in giving encouragement and helping others on their way. Because so many people were helpful to me along that way. So I knew from a pretty young age that I wanted to be a pastor. I hadn't really figured everything out yet.
Sure.
But you come to SEM and you begin to really, it starts to take shape.
Yeah.
And you have your classes in which you learn things, but I think that even more than just the content of the classes, what you learn in the classes, the seminary forms you and shapes you in ways that you don't really expect.
Yeah.
You go into situations where you're going to learn, and it may not be the way that you expect that you'll learn, but nevertheless, it can be a very positive experience. And so I came here, and it was kind of like putting on an old pair of tennis shoes. It felt like a really good fit.
Sure.
And so that's part of the reason why I think I'm so thrilled to be here still, because the whole project of theological education is just such a wonderful thing to participate in. I never really get tired of it.
I get asked quite often, especially from classmates, because I'm coming up on 7 years of graduating from here with my MDiv, of what it's like to work here, and then people, I'm blessed to live on campus as well. And, when you graduate, we all prepare, right? You're here for 4 years, and then we're always told, enjoy the time that you're here, because you're going to go off, you're going to be far away from each other, and this is a moment. And I never put it in my plan that, someday I'd be working back at the seminary, living here again, let alone as quickly as it happened after leaving. And people ask what it's like to be back. I'm like, well, it's like it was mm-hmm. when we were here mm-hmm. as students. I was like, I'm doing something different for the seminary, but we still talk about preaching with mm-hmm. each other. We talk about God's word amongst each other, what we're doing, not just here for our students, but how that translates into the world and all this other stuff. It's like, so it's not the same formative process, but it's still the same formative culture. I'm very blessed to be around faculty members who taught me in my MDiv, well, now in my PhD work and beyond, but just to be able to say, hey, like I was reading this thing from this book or talking about the 17th century Lutherans. One day, mm-hmm. let's have a coffee and talk about guys like Friedrich Schleiermacher. Mm-hmm. Those guys from, that's kind of like early modernity, right?
Yeah, sure.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. We just speak a different language. Anyway, but to be able to have that and be able to say, hey, Dr. Bode, like I was reading I asked a couple other people, like, do you know about this Schleiermacher guy? Help me out, understand him. And then now I'm reading other guys, and he's very influential and Lutheranism. Anyway, but to have that, and it's like, you know, so, and I tell guys, so come back for symposia whenever you got a chance, whenever we're having an event, come back, because it's not forever, but it's just that little refresher that this is a very special place mm-hmm. where we are doing something that is very central to God's word for the sake of the church, but like you just can't, it would be hard to like, of course you can have another seminary somewhere else, but this one in particular, where we are in the world, in the church body that we serve, is just it's just remarkable. And you just got to mm-hmm. come and breathe it in, experience it for a little while, and hopefully, if you haven't been a student here yet, spend a day mm-hmm. or two here. You'll want to. Mm-hmm. As you were talking about that, and just how special this place is, how it forms you in all these unexpected ways, it just kind of.
I think one of the things that has always surprised me, and it surprised me when I first came here as a student, and it surprises me to this day, that you know, you come in kind of thinking, well, I'm going to learn a lot in my classes, right? And you do. Mm-hmm. A lot of great stuff that is so precious and valuable. It changes the way you think about God and your relationship, you know, who we are before God and who God is and so forth. But one of the things that I was always surprised at how much I learned from my other fellow students.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
I never expected that. Now, I should have expected it, I suppose. But you have all these conversations with students outside of class, over a cup of coffee, in the library, at lunch, in the dorm, wherever you happen to be. And I learned all kinds of insights, not simply about stuff I should have learned in my classes but hadn't caught up to yet, mm-hmm. you know, the class stuff they were helpful to me with. But it was sharing about their own personal faith, their own life. Some of the most important things that I learned about my Christian faith and life, I learned outside of class, talking with fellow students. A lot of them were older students. You know, guys were, you know, a couple years older than me.
Sure. Yeah.
And so one of the things I began to realize was it's really the content, the classes, the stuff we learn is really important. It's great. But the people are the greatest thing about this place.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And we have new people coming in all the time. It's one of the kind of bittersweet things about the seminary, is that every spring we see this great group of people leave,
right,
go off to be pastors or deaconesses or teachers or missionaries. And then just a few months later, a whole nother group comes.
Right.
And we don't know them and they don't know us and they might not know each other very well. But over the next few months, we get to know each other really well.
Yeah.
And we grow to love each other and care for each other. And next thing you know, we're 4 years have gone by. And it's one of those things that is, I don't know, I can't really put it into words. It's a miracle that God sends these wonderful young people here.
Mm. Yeah.
I don't know. You guys have the joy of kind of seeing them before the professors and the staff do come in. You get to know them right at the beginning of the process. But it is one of the most amazing things about this place is that God is the one that is leading and calling mm-hmm. new people to come here.
There's all these different ways that he's doing that mm-hmm. too. And I wanted to follow up a little bit on your story, because it's really interesting to me that you have this story that some of our students have, right, which is that their dad was a pastor or a church worker, and they saw their dad or their mother in a church work profession, and it was really fulfilling. Mm-hmm. And they really loved their work, and it was a healthy congregation or a school, and so it was just kind of infectious. That's not every student's story.
Yeah.
I don't come from a long line of church workers. But I think some people do. What has it been like? What's it like to be kind of the several generations of pastors? Did you ever have doubts like, am I as good as my dad? Everything that you said is just, I would say for our listeners and viewers, is just so genuine, Jerry Bodhi. It was just this nice story of your upbringing, and you're just grateful for things. And that's really amazing.
It's true.
Amazing.
This is history. I don't have to make stuff up. It's history.
I know, right? And that's what I want our listeners. I mean, he's not like glossing over these deep, dark secrets from his past. He had a really just, and this is just who you are. I'm kind of fascinated by that. I feel sometimes like my story is so kind of like tumultuous and all over the place.
Well, I think it's not something that I really spent a lot of time thinking about. But sure. You ask about, do I compare myself to my dad? No, not really. My dad has always been a better preacher than me. And he has gifts and talents and skills and abilities that I still kind of I'm just marvel at. I guess in some ways I kind of try to be like him in some of the things that I did. And I'm very grateful for the example that he set for me. My brother is a pastor, and he's a pastor in upstate New York. And I'm sure he would say the same thing, that our father was such an influence on it, but it was a positive one. And that doesn't mean that my dad didn't have difficult times or difficult things, because he did. I mean, just being a pastor, there are difficult things you have to deal with. But I think that it was his witness of joyful faith. Yeah. And he loved doing what he was doing.
Wow.
And it was just kind of always apparent. You know, there was truly joyful in what he was doing. And I think that has kind of that positive view, I think it was kind of rubbed off on me. There's going to be difficult times. But I think one of the things that my dad always kind of taught me was that we, you know, you go back to God's word, and that's where you find your rock solid confidence and assurance. Yeah. When things get bad, go back to that. And that's, you know, it's just part of the cycle that you're in when you're in a congregation, whether you're sitting in the pew or you're in the pulpit up front. It's that constant weekly participation in the life of the church and the word of God, coming back and hearing preaching and Bible teaching and things like that keep you grounded. Yeah. And I think that's something that's really important. And you don't have to be a pastor's kid to see the importance of that, or I think to even grow up that way. When we're kind of tethered to God's word in our life, tethered to the gospel of Christ, there's a surety and a certainty and a joy that we find that is kind of unshakable. So no matter what happens, you're going to be okay, even through the very difficult times. I think that the students here, and faculty, I'm sure, but students here kind of grow in that knowledge, in that awareness while they're here, and they start to support each other.
Yeah.
When one of us is, or one of the students, or one of the faculty, if we're having a hard time, we rally around each other and support. We pray for each other. I can't not tell you how many times I've told a student or a fellow professor, well, I'll keep you in my prayers, and I mean it when I say that.
Yeah. Yeah.
And it's not just a throwaway, but we actually pray for each other, not just in chapel, but we pray for each other outside of that in class or wherever. And that I think that true love and care for one another is something that you find in a local congregation. You find it here as well. And it's really a special thing.
So it's so fun to listen to you talk and to hear the joy that just very naturally flows out of you. I think I've never met your father before. I don't recall.
You'd love him,
but yeah. You, from everything you've said about him, I think knowing you, it's absolutely true that there's just this joy and this faith that says things are going to be okay. Mm-hmm. And what God is doing for us in Jesus, mm-hmm. is all the joy and the hope that we will ever need, even to bring us through some particularly mm-hmm. hard times. That's a really important thing to, especially if there are any parents that are listening, to speak about the joy of faith. Mm-hmm. It's probably something that you don't hear that on the evening news, mm-hmm. right?
Yeah.
You get formed by listening to people that have the joy of the Lord. Mm-hmm. So I'm interested in the history of our church. I'm interested in some of these stories of going way back to, say, the founding of our church body. They thought that it would be a good idea to have a seminary where pastors would, or potential pastors would come to study and then be sent out from that place to become pastors for the Lutheran Church Missouri Synod. And you've studied a little bit. So how did we end up with a seminary?
Well, that's a good question. It's one of those things starting a seminary, especially something like Concordia Seminary, this is not an easy thing to do,
no. Right?
You know, to get something like this going. So as you would imagine, the beginnings are rather humble. And that's why we have a log cabin on our campus, which, by the way, was built in the late 1930s. It was constructed out of logs from Perry County, Missouri, hewn by a man who was a resident of Perry County. He built the thing himself. He came up here and built it on our campus. Actually, where the chapel is now is where that log cabin was originally placed. Of course, now it's by the library.
Right. I remember when it was over by Lober.
Sure.
For a time,
yeah,
but it was
it
originally where the library is.
A few years ago, I actually asked if I could have that as my... I'm the seminary archivist,
right,
you know, so
right,
I have to
right.
keep track of all this old stuff. And I actually asked if I could have that log cabin as my office.
A little drafty.
There were two conditions that went along with my request. One is, would they put in, you know, Wi-Fi for me?
Yeah.
And the other one was, would they get rid of the rats? And right. and no was the answer, because there weren't any rats. There aren't any rats in there. But no. So I
would also have to remove the... sometimes we use it to store the caroler statues that we put out.
Yeah.
I took some.
It's a nice little creepy touch.
I took some kindergarten kids in there. They were here visiting from a neighboring school, and when we went into the log cabin, there had been an accident. One of the carolers had lost his head, and so the ceramic head of the caroler was sitting in there, and the kids were kind of freaked out.
That's how good stories are born.
Yeah, right, you know? Exactly.
You're walking by at night, and there's a headless figure in the window. Exactly. Yeah, that's good.
In the window, the headless caroler.
Right, yeah.
That we could probably, like, I'm sure that there's some kind of tale that we could start. It
probably
happened here on Under the Fig Tree.
Well,
so it starts with the log cabin.
It starts with the log cabin in the fall of 1839 in Perry County, Missouri, which is about 100 miles south of here,
mm-hmm.
Down by the Mississippi River down there. And, of course, the seminary there was founded by Saxon immigrants who had come over earlier that year and wanted to establish a Christian community here in Missouri. The idea, whatever, several hundred, about 600 or 700 of them that all came over. And so they wanted to start their own Christian community here, and they thought Perry County, which is a lovely place, beautiful, that would be a good place to do that. And so they founded their churches and started building out, you know, carving out lives for themselves down there, starting farms and businesses and things like that. But of course, one of the things that they needed right away was a school. And so that was one of the first projects, was to build a school, which would be housed in this log cabin. But I think it's kind of interesting that the dedication of those people to build a school was really significant. They were, that winter of 1839, 1840, there were still people living in tents. Wow. Down there. They hadn't built homes for themselves. In the wintertime. They were living in tents in the wintertime, but they had a school. That gives you a sense of where their you know, their dedication was. That education, they wanted their kids to be able to go to school and to continue to learn.
And a church, I'm assuming.
And a church as well, yeah. There were a number of churches in various areas down there. That was, of course, a priority as well. But the school that would become Perry County really began, that became the log cabin school that would become Concordia Seminary, was really kind of like an academy. It had 11 students when it opened in December of 1839, 7 boys and 4 girls. And so it was kind of like an elementary school / junior high school kind of a thing. But I think significantly, the students that would begin there would continue their education, and within just a few years would be training to be, they were seminary students, they were being trained in theology. And so were a big handful of young men that graduated from that institution that went on to be pastors. The first one actually graduated in 1847, and there were a number of them after that. 1847 was the year that the synod was founded. So of course, the problem that they had was that they didn't have any other place to get pastors from. Many of the early pastors came from Germany, and we were reliant on young men coming from Germany, or pastors from Germany. Right. You know, well into the 1880s, 1890s. The synod has almost always had a shortage of pastors from 1847 all the way to the present day. There was a little bit of a lull there in the 1930s during the Depression when they had. It was a little difficult,
right?
But otherwise, we've always needed pastors.
Well, that's one of those things, because that's like in recruiting questions people ask: do we need more pastors? It's like, well, you can think about the status quo, right? Because there are congregations that don't have pastors that need them, and I'm not saying never think about them, but that is part of why we exist, trying to get them a pastor. Think about all the people who don't yet know the gospel. How are they going to hear it, and who's going to preach it, and how are they going to, the whole Romans 10 scenario, as that the human population grows, we need more and more pastors. And it's just one of those things where it's like, can we support more congregations? It's like, well, you're asking the wrong questions and all this other stuff. So that's interesting to know that it's probably, I mean, it seems even Paul and in the early church, they probably were struggling with this reality as well.
Well, and part of that has to do with how big of a vision do you have for what the mission is.
Sure.
And different people throughout our synod's history have had different visions, right? But from what I read of Walther, the founding president of our church body, he had a pretty ambitious vision for what he wanted to do, the kinds of people that he wanted to reach. You'll always have a shortage of pastors if you have a big enough vision.
Right. And they did.
Yeah.
And of course the country was big. The country was growing.
Right.
The American frontier, even out in the eastern part, I suppose, as well, but certainly in the Midwest, where the Saxons were located, it was a largely unchurched place. They couldn't get pastors. It didn't matter whether you were Lutheran or Reformed or, you know, Baptist or Methodist. They didn't have enough pastors, and so there's
They were unchurched because there wasn't a church.
Right.
Yeah,
right.
Not because they were
heathens.
Some of them had come over and had been going to a church back in the day, but then where'd he go to church?
So the need was always there. And I think that that's it was one of the compelling reasons why they wanted to have a school that would eventually train up Lutheran teachers as well, but also pastors. And so when the synod was founded in 1847, the question was, you know, immediately in the fore, how are we going to train pastors for this new synod that we've got, this new church? And of course, back in 1846, there had been a seminary school that had been founded in Fort Wayne. Pastor Sealer was one of the early pastors there. I think it was at St. Paul's in Fort Wayne. He had started with a couple of other guys had started a little seminary there. And when the synod was founded in 1847, that little school in Fort Wayne, which we know today as Concordia Theological Seminary, our sister seminary, that school was given to the synod. So they had one seminary there. But then we had this other school in Perry County, and the question was, can we have a pastoral training center here in the West in Missouri as well? And within just a couple of years, the folks down in Perry County that had the school, the congregations down there, gifted their school and the teachers to the synod. Mm-hmm. And which is really kind of an amazing thing that they did that, because they could have kind of kept that for themselves and run it, but no, they wanted it to be part of the synod. But they also wanted C.F.W. Walther, who had been one of the pastors in Perry County and now was up here in St. Louis, they wanted him to be one of the professors at the school. Mm-hmm. So that's why it was moved to St. Louis in 1849. And then in 1850, they got their own first building here in St. Louis. And so we've been here ever since. And
that building was down by the river, right?
Well it was
closer to the river.
Closer to the river. It was actually right behind where Holy Cross Lutheran Church is now, a kitty corner from Concordia Publishing House. It's a very historic district down there in South City, next to along Jefferson Avenue. But that's where that school originally was. Walther's congregation, Trinity, had been very close to the river. Mm-hmm. An interesting story that I love about Walther, you were talking about his mission interest. And the story is told about C.F.W. Walther that his congregation, which was later called Trinity, was just a couple of blocks up from the river. Today, if you go down where the arch and the arch grounds are in St. Louis, this Walther's congregation is just south of there, a couple blocks. That's where he was serving. And the story is that he would, when the riverboats, of course, St. Louis is a huge, important river city. There's lots of riverboats coming up, lots of traffic coming in, lots of people coming into St. Louis all the time. And so he would have, all these riverboats would come up and unload there right on the riverbank. And Walther and other people from the congregation would go down there and introduce themselves to people as they were getting off the boats. Mm. And probably could kind of identify what people that looked like they were maybe Germans, and they could go talk to them, probably other people as well. But the Germans, they might have a connection with because they spoke the same language. And but it was kind of interesting. Walther could come up to them and introduce himself and say, you know, my congregation I serve is right there, just down the street. You know, churches at services at 8 and 10:30 on Sunday morning with Bible class at 9:50. You know, something like that. Come on, and if you need a
coffee and donuts,
right. We'd love to see you. And by the way, if you need anything while you're here in the city, you know where to find me. So he was able to make a connection with people, invite them to church right away. That congregation just grew like crazy.
Yeah.
In part because they had this mission focus, this mission emphasis, very early on. And I think that's one thing that you see this with people like C.F.W. Walther, with Winniken, with other people in the early history of the Missouri Synod. They always understood that really the central task of the church is reaching out with the gospel to those who haven't heard it. Yeah. So there's a very important central emphasis on mission that's so prevalent in so much of the work that they're doing early on. They are concerned about holding fast to the teachings of the scriptures. They're concerned about holding fast to the teachings of the Lutheran confessions, the Lutheran Reformation. That's always there, and it's always very important.
Right. Mm-hmm.
But I think it's that combination
of
holding fast to God's word and bringing that God's word to people who need it that continues to this day.
Yeah.
It should be a primary focus to this day.
I've been working on this book on mission history and Walther and the founding fathers. And one of the stories that I've come across that I was really interested in is Binger, one of Walther's friends and becomes his brother-in-law, right?
Right, yeah.
Binger was a pastor at Bethlehem, I think, right? Or some congregation a little bit further north.
Emmanuel.
Emmanuel.
Right. It was one of those, one of the group of congregations in that, yeah.
So he found out about, he knew of this Chinese population that lived here in St. Louis who were, for a lot of, it's probably a rather unfortunate story, were brought here to work on the railroads. Mm-hmm. But there was a large Chinese population, and Binger took it upon himself to reach out to them in Christian love and with the gospel, and he had a huge Chinese mission here in St. Louis. Mm-hmm. There were people that were learning Chippewa to speak to Native Americans up in Minnesota, and so yeah, there's just some fascinating stories about. Are the founders of the Lutheran Church of Missouri Synod and their love for mission.
And if I'm not mistaken, because, you know, it's one of these things, you're talking about reaching out with the gospel. We do that in a variety of ways. Acts of mercy works and things like that. And if you brought up Pastor Binger. Isn't he kind of the foundational piece that started or was behind starting the Lutheran Hospital that's also on that same block? It no longer belongs to us. There's a legacy that still belongs to us, but isn't he kind of the one?
Yeah, 1858, he founded the Lutheran Hospital because there were people that were
sick
and needed help, and so he said, "Well, let's get organized here, and while we're at it, we might as well have a nurses school as well because we need nurses to serve in the hospital," and it just kind of goes on from there. That's the kind of person that he was. One part of that story, I'm sure you guys know this, but that Binger suffered mightily in his own personal life. He was married twice. His first wife died of cholera in 1849, along with a son that had just been born. Before that, they lost three sons. Mm-hmm. Binger married a second woman. They had four children, two of whom died. And the man saw one of his wives and six of his children die. His response is to basically dedicate his life, aside from being a pastor, he dedicates his life to human care, whether it be a hospital or an orphan home or mission work. He was, at the time he died, he was trying to establish an institute for foundlings, for children who were just dropped off, babies that were dropped off. He wanted to have a special home for them. He was working on a home for the elderly. And I'm sure there are others that I don't even remember. It was just... basically, anything that human beings needed in their spiritual and physical lives, he was trying to make it better.
Wow.
And somebody should write a whole book about him. Somebody probably has already, I don't know, but amazing.
Walther has this short little biography of Binger, and it is so devotional.
Yeah.
It is just filled with, people think sometimes, people mistakenly think, oh, history... boring, it's just dates, and but you start reading this stuff, and these people have enormous faith, they live through way harder things than I've ever lived through in my personal life.
Just because somebody will comment, what's the name of this devotional that you're speaking of, or this short biography?
Well, it's
is it published?
It's in our library.
It's in the library.
It's got a kind of homemade maroon cover. Yeah. I think it's probably in my office right now, well, checked out. But we need to. We probably should republish it.
It should be.
It is. At one point, I think it was just in like a three-ring binder or something. Hmm. I think it's maybe just a photocopied. Thing it was translated, but brief biography of J.M. Binger or something.
Yeah,
by
Walther.
By Walther. Okay. That was essentially put together at the end of Binger's life, upon his death.
Right.
It's got a funeral sermon, and it tells this kind of amazing story of how the Great Awakening was kind of part of their story that swept across Germany and how they came to faith. And they were very zealous for the gospel.
They were.
Well, I'm currently taking Creeds and Confessions with Dr. Kolb. I was just telling Ben yesterday that, you know, talking about our library and blessings, we every time that Dr. Kolb teaches this class, he takes his class to the rare books, and everybody gets a 16th century Book of Concord. And somebody didn't want it for some crazy reason. Well, anyway, I ended up getting past our copy of the Heidelberg. It's just, and Dr. Kolb will do this because he owns rare books, and you get them in front of you, and you think you have to treat them like this delicate thing that's going to fall apart, although it's lasted nearly 500 years. But he's like, it's just a book. It's like, well, for you, Dr. Kolb, yes, it is just a book. But for me, for that class, we read Testing the Boundaries by Dr. Arend, which is kind of this history of American Lutheranism. Mm-hmm. And we're talking about challenges and things like that because the LCMS, we weren't the first Lutherans to get to this country. And by the time we got here, there was already a movement towards American Lutheranism. And I was just having this conversation. People were like, well, I like to look to the future. I'm like, that's great. Look to the future. But it's like, what is it, John F. Kennedy? If we forget the past, then we're destined to repeat our failures, something along those lines. But there are important lessons in that of how American Lutheranism was trying to take shape. Then we come along. And can you just speak a little bit? I don't know how interested everybody is about the history of American Lutheranism, but it is important because, again, we have a way of thinking that we're it, not just American Lutheranism, but historic German 16th century Lutheranism is the LCMS. Like, we're it. But what did that look like? What did it take shape, and how did it impact us, and how did we impact American Lutheranism in return?
Well, Lutherans had been on this continent since the early 17th century.
Right.
You know, the 16 teens probably, the first Lutherans are there. They don't always have churches, but there are some Lutherans there. They're out in places, you know, like Delaware and New Jersey and New York and places like that very early. And they had well-established churches there that you know, are still there to this day. But the folks that would found the Missouri Synod really came in the 19th century, almost 200 years at least after the earlier ones had arrived. They had a different outlook on things. In part, it was informed by what had been going on in Germany.
Right.
Ben, you were talking about the revival over in Germany, or we might talk about the confessional revival or the awakening, reawakening of a Lutheran confessional consciousness. That really comes in response to the Enlightenment.
Yeah.
And a lot of other factors, but there's a huge resurgence of interest in Lutheran teaching in the German lands, but in Scandinavia as well. In the early 19th century, there's a revival of interest in the life of Martin Luther, Luther's works, Luther's theology, and also the Lutheran confessions. And so people are looking; they had been kind of forgotten or perhaps neglected for a while. But there's a resurgence of interest in that in the 19th century, and people are going back and reading those things again. Those people who are influenced by that come over to America. And in a sense, the confessional revival emigrates to America. And while there would be some people in American Lutheranism in the eastern part of the country who would understand this revival and would be part of it, the folks that would found the Missouri Synod were really dedicated to this. And I think a good way to think about this was that what people like C.F.W. Walther or Winniken or others founders of the Synod really wanted to do was that they wanted the truth of the Scriptures, the true understanding of the Gospel as interpreted or as retold by the Lutheran confessions, they wanted that to have a bearing and a voice in this country. And they thought that would be the best way for the Lutheran Church, or really for the Christian Church, to be able to fulfill its mission would be to hold fast to those things in this place.
And partly because that voice had been squelched somewhat back in Prussia,
right?
Because the king had decided, you know, what's the difference between a Lutheran and a Calvinist. Mm-hmm. Can't we just all get along?
Yeah.
And he gave them a new hymn book that kind of cut through. Don't worry about all those differences, right? The government knows what's best for you. And they didn't care for that so much.
No, there was a reaction against that. Yeah. People thought, well, you know, maybe the differences are there for a reason. Maybe they do matter.
Yeah.
And that was part of the, you're exactly right, that was part of the response to all that. So I think that legacy or that concern is something that we still have in our church today. I mean, it shapes even what we do here at the seminary.
Yeah.
You know, so much of our emphasis comes from that. And to answer your question, Mike, I think that's what they were trying to do.
Sure.
And that, in some respects, was what the contribution that they wanted to make to American Lutheranism was that kind of concern. Yeah.
Well, because we would all say it does matter. And then, because in the grand scheme of things, right, there is one holy Christian and apostolic church. This is what we confess in our faith. And we certainly don't believe that only Lutherans are saved. Mm-hmm. And that's not the issue here and now. The issue here and now is that I love, again, Dr. Kolb, when he says this, he's on a sunny day, it doesn't really matter whether you're a Lutheran or not. But on a rainy day, that's when being a Lutheran really matters, because when life is against you, where do you find and locate your assurance that even though life is terrible right now, even though six of my children and one of my wives has died, how do I know that God doesn't hate me?
Right.
Well, it's in the gospel, and then it really matters. And this is when people, especially if you've never taken the time to go through the confessions, and I get it, the setting for them is 500 years ago, and it is a very dense and long, very thick theological book. And if you've never taken the time to go through it, you might not see those nuances, those differences. We're going through AC4 and the apology right now. Mm. And that's where justification and the importance of our confession of faith, of what we stand on and why we're not Roman Catholic and why really we're not something else. It's not so much just for standing apart's sake, but it's for the sake of the people that we serve, that we're preaching to, that we're called to serve. The point is that those differences are important. And what I've found in my short tenure as being a pastor is that those Lutheran distinctions, the ones that really matter, justification, when people, our view of the gospel, when people encounter that for the first time, it matters to them as well. Mm-hmm. And they could have grown up in the church. And then you say, I get it. I understand what you're saying. But think about it this way. And you bring that Lutheran perspective to their life. I've seen people cry over this because they've grown up in the church, and they've grown up in the church experiencing life, wondering if God hated them. And then they hear the gospel rightly for the first time. It brings them to tears because, no, God doesn't hate me. And it's such a beautiful thing that when people are always asking about these distinctions, why do we have all these different denominations? It's for your everyday life and really for your sake and as your pastor. Mm-hmm. That's why we've just taken the time to go through the small catechism to learn this stuff. It's such a beautiful thing.
Mm-hmm. The nice thing about this is that you don't have to lead with your denomination or the differences. You lead with the gospel.
Yep.
Yeah.
In whatever context you're in, you know, if you're walking down the street or you're in an airplane or you're in a hospital room and there's someone else in the bed next door there, you lead with the gospel of Jesus. And then it doesn't really matter after that. You can talk about the small stuff later on.
Right.
You know.
Micah mentioned the small catechism, though, which is kind of the next step, right? After somebody hears the gospel and they say, well, I really trust that, or I want that, then for Lutherans, the next step for somebody has typically been, well, let's take a look at this small catechism. Mm-hmm. You spent a lot of time in your early career studying the catechisms in the Lutheran Church, and a catechism from one particular author. Tell us a little bit about the importance of a catechism for Lutherans and what it means to be Lutheran, to have this catechism.
The catechism is really a handbook for the Christian faith and life. And it's something that you can go back to over and over and over again. Whether it's the small catechism of Luther or the large catechism, Small Catechism is very brief. It doesn't take very long to read. You can easily read it in a sitting. Large Catechism takes a little bit more time. It's more kind of devotional. Mm. But it is really kind of a handbook. And, you know, I'm really grateful to professors like Dr. Kolb or Dr. Arend and others that kind of helped me, when I was a student here, helped me see and understand this a little bit better. What Luther is giving us there is, in a sense, the summary of the scriptures. Yeah. The Bible in a summary. In fact, the Formula of Concord, actually, one of our confessional writings, actually says that it's the summary of the Bible.
Which is nice, because the Bible can be, yeah. I love the scriptures, but they can be kind of overwhelming. Yeah. And there's a lot, if you pick up at, like, you know, Leviticus or something, mm-hmm. you can get lost pretty quickly.
Yeah. It summarizes down the key teachings. I think what it really kind of gets at is a couple of key questions, I think, that often people have. First of all, who is God? The Small Catechism has a lot to say about who God is,
yeah.
and whether it be in the commandments or the creed or the Lord's Prayer or other things. Who is God? And then who are we before God? And the Small Catechism has a lot of answers to that. Hmm. I think it kind of comes back to that. I think one of the brilliant things about the Catechism, and Luther really makes this point well, I think, that you kind of go back to basics. The Catechism takes you back to the basics.
Yeah.
And when you go back to, and this is something that I think is really helpful, in, even for adults in our daily life, when we get busy with all kinds of different things and there's lots of stress and lots of strain, there's something really kind of wonderfully comforting about going back to the basics, back to the Ten Commandments, back to the Creed, back to the Lord's Prayer, back to a reminder of who God has made us, who He's called us to be in baptism, what He gives us in the words of forgiveness in the absolution, what He gives us in the Lord's Supper. It kind of takes us back to those basic things again that kind of fix us and put us back on the right track and support us. But they also kind of leads us back to the scriptures again and encourage us to go back and read more. Yeah. And that combo, I think, is just so, so precious. So it's really a little manual for Christian faith and life we can use throughout our lives, not just for young people in confirmation class, but for adults.
Yeah, Luther said he would never be done with it, right?
Yeah.
That he was a doctor of theology, and he still prayed the little parts of the catechism every day.
Right. I think that's a really good practice, and trying to go back and as he said, pray the catechism,
yeah,
and use it devotionally, meditate on the words, especially the words of God that are in the catechism, which is just central to our faith.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. That's so good.
Well, at All Nations, as we were wrapping up, and so by the time people hear us now, it's sometime middle of March, but I was preaching at All Nations last Sunday in February, and we were wrapping up the Small Catechism. And I used the illustration of Rosa Young, who didn't grow up a Lutheran, mm-hmm. but reached out to the Lutheran Church to help in her mission. And she says, it was never my intention to teach Luther Small Catechism. But what she discovered, in her mission to help rural black children in Alabama learn how to read, and what she discovered in the Small Catechism, and which, you know, she refers to as the six chief parts of our faith, mm-hmm. right? She reflected on the reality that the churches that she had grown up in, the preachers were preaching false doctrine, but they didn't know it because they didn't understand it. And that now, through her ability to teach, because she wanted to teach children the faith as well, that was part of her literacy program, but her discovery of the Small Catechism for her and her life, and now for these children and for the people around her, how transformative it was. And that's mm-hmm. what I tell people all the time. Like, if you go outside of our circles, and if anybody knows anything about Lutheranism, I would say 9 times out of 10, it's the Small Catechism. And they don't know anything else about us, but they really like that. It's just this little treasure that I should do it more often, but when I do walk through the Small Catechism with somebody, and it's fresh every single time. Mm-hmm. The words never get old. When we do it in chapel, and we do the catechetical, is that Fridays.
Yeah, Fridays.
Yeah, where we have that catechetical instruction, and you just do the confirmation thing. What does this mean? And memory work comes mm-hmm. back. All the way down to Luther's morning and evening prayer. This is what I pray with my children mm-hmm. before they go to bed, and they pray right along with me. And you don't need new words. The small prayer book of the small catechism is mm-hmm. it's just enough to carry you through it. I love it so much.
I learned it in Lutheran grade school, and so it in some ways it feels like putting on an old pair of shoes. Mm-hmm. They fit, and sometimes you can take that for granted.
Yeah.
And I remember meeting a Haitian pastor in South Florida that I would eventually go to Haiti with. But he was such a big fan of the small catechism. Mm. It had really shaped his faith in a truly genuine way. And having grown up with it all my life, it was one of those things that I will admit I took for granted mm-hmm. how beautiful of a treasure it was. And when I heard this Haitian Lutheran pastor talking about how important the small catechism was for grounding his understanding of what happens in baptism and who God is, it was like, oh, mm-hmm. maybe this wasn't just something that I had to do in eighth grade to like get confirmed. Right, my pastors growing up were wonderful, godly pastors, but they also made us just mm-hmm. memorize the darn catechism. Mm-hmm. And it took me as an adult seeing it through somebody else's eyes to realize, oh, this is really a profound mm-hmm. book. And has profoundly mm-hmm. shaped lives. So good. Well, we could talk on and on and on. The part of the reason that I love about this, what I love about this podcast is we get to talk with professors, and I hope that listeners kind of say, "Gosh, don't get to the ripe for the picking part yet, because we want to hear more history." And that's the reason why you should come to Concordia Seminary, is so that you can hear more stories. I thought you were going to tell the story about CFW Walther going swimming and falling into a hole in the Mississippi River. Another story for another day.
Right.
But we probably should get to ripe for the picking. And so I'm going to ask the first one it doesn't get stolen from me. We were talking a little bit before we started recording about figs. Are figs ripe for the picking, or would you actually just leave figs on the tree?
I love figs. I'll take it.
All right.
Ripe for the picking. Well, actually, I do. I've always liked figs.
Yeah.
I'm not sure what that means or what that says, but I do. But, you know, I came here, and even these are actually like fig leaves here. You got real figs. Well, they look like real figs. My grandparents had a fig tree or a big fig bush in their backyard when I was a kid in Oklahoma, where they lived. And we used to go out and pick them and harvest them and bring them into my grandmother, and she'd cut some up and we could try them, or she'd make jam out of them. Mm. And it was always kind of a fun thing. Figs are ancient.
Yeah.
We often think of them as this kind of, you know, Mediterranean, exotic Mediterranean thing. But they had them all over the place in Oklahoma. Surely we could grow them here in St. Louis. Do they have them on campus?
Oh, sure. Yeah. I thought when Ben brought this up one day, I thought he was lying. But there are four or five fig bushes on the academic quad side of Werner.
Oh.
Yeah.
We've picked them and we've eaten them on
the show.
On the show, yeah.
I love figs.
Yeah, I guess I've probably always been too late for them. I don't see them growing there. Someone else has got it. I mean, we can grow just about anything here in St. Louis. It's mm-hmm. such a great climate for growing all different kinds of
figs
things.
Figs grow well in shade, I think, right?
Yeah.
And so they do pretty well on that side. Oh, yeah, figs are ripe for the picking for me, and I've talked about figs a lot on the show. But one thing that I probably have never said is that I also love Fig Newtons.
Oh, yeah, I love Fig Newtons.
And I have a package of Fig Newtons in a drawer of my desk right now because, you know, every once in a while you're in the middle of your mm-hmm. day and you're like, I think I need a Fig Newton.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, they're kind of an old school cookie, but
yeah, it's a nutrition bar.
I just love it. It's a nutrition bar, exactly. Mike has got some friends that founded and sold. Nature's Bakery.
Yeah.
And that really is a health food. I'm not sure the Fig Newton classifies as a health bar anymore. But
they were very well.
Ripe for the picking for me.
The Marsons were very intentional about Nature's Bakery. Yeah. Well, and when they're in town, they go to Historic Trinity. Hmm. They're members there when they're in town. So figs themselves, I had never tried one until a fresh one, an actual. Because I grew up eating Fig Newtons. I love Fig Newtons, but an actual just fig. I was like, why would anybody eat a fig? You do whatever you do to process it into a Fig Newton. That's what figs are for. The flavor was good. The texture on this particular one was a little off for me. And texture means everything to me when it comes to food. Mm. So they are ripe for the picking. I'd give it another chance. I would love to see, now that everybody knows where the figs are, let's see what we can do to
I need to find some good figs. I'll find some good figs and we'll have figs. Next time we have you on, we're gonna
good. And as Ben was talking, you know, the story about your grandma cutting them up and then making jam. You've sold
sounds
me.
Sounds delicious.
Yeah, exactly. Right. Like I'm 100% really bought in. So
especially if you put a little bacon in there.
Bacon
fig jam.
Everything, though. I don't know
if you're into gourmet figs. Fix it.
Whatever it takes. But bacon does make everything taste good. And probably gourmet too, right?
Well, on the topic of the Reformation, these are always all random. And I don't know what made me think about this the other day. But right for the pick and leave it on the tree, that classic 1517 Wittenberg monk's haircut. Right for the pick and leave it on the tree.
I'll leave that one on the tree.
I never had the monk's haircut. But I did have the haircut that was typically described as the bowl cut.
Oh, sure.
just shave directly into the side of your head and shave everything. So that's the only thing that came to my mind when you said the monk's haircut. Yeah, I've never had a.
How much would it cost cowl to get you to do it? If somebody with a lot of money wanted to donate to the seminary for a good cause.
We used to have St. Baldrick's Day and shave heads on campus. And my wife always said, if you think that you want to raise money for doing that, I will pay however much money you think you can raise for you not to shave your head bald. It would take a lot of money. Right. Because, and here's the real reason, because she seed me with my head shaved bald, and that's leave it on the tree for her.
Okay. Yeah. It's leave it on the tree for me. I'm going to be 100% honest. That might be a top five worst thing that's ever come out of Western Europe. It's terrible. I don't know what the purpose of it was. I'm sure there is some purpose for them cutting their hair like that. But it's preposterous, whatever the reason
Paul,
is.
Paul Robinson can give you a lecture on that. Yeah,
it was a bad idea. I doubt it accomplished its purpose anyway.
All right, ripe for the picking or leave it on the tree, another food one, charcuterie.
I'll take it. Yeah. I'll pick that. Yeah, I love it. Yeah.
Do you have any particular meat that you would say, oh, man, that would be the first thing that I would pick off of a charcuterie board?
Well, I suppose it depends on how diverse it is. Mm. But if you're looking at German stuff, if we put some German things on there.
Yeah, yeah.
I mean, I would have to say the smoked Braunschweiger at G&W Meats.
Oh, yeah, yeah, yeah.
That's just absolutely. I mean, I was down there a few weeks ago, and they're like, no, we don't have that. I said, will you let me know? I mean, they have a board in there of call this person when it comes in because it's so fantastic.
That's awesome. But I love that place.
Yeah, it's you never know what great new thing they'll have in there when you go. But, you know, St. Louis is such a great town for Italian food and Italian sausage. Yeah. We have some of the best Italian sausage. I mean, I spent quite a bit of time in Italy when I was younger. This is world class for Italian food in St. Louis. We have fantastic.
Volpi. Yeah.
I don't know how you could find better Italian sausage. Right. It's hard salami.
Right, yeah.
Really, really great. Yeah,
so good.
Yeah.
Yeah, it's ripe for the picking for me too. I'll take it all. I'll do mousse or some kind of meat spread. We've talked about lard on this show before.
Yeah.
Schmaltzbrot. But I also love all the vegetables, pickles, little gherkins or cornichons or pickled onions. Mm-hmm.
Throw some olives on there.
So yeah, it's all ripe for the picking for me.
Prosciutto, definitely. I will say I can't eat the schmaltzbrot, the lard, even if it has little bits of bacon in it on a pizza. Yeah. I just can't do it.
Oh.
But you know what it is? I think it's because I remember my grandpa Bodie used to telling me about the guys that he knew in southern Minnesota growing up back in the 1920s, these farmers that would drink a hot cup of lard before they go out to work in the morning.
Sure.
And I said, well,
a lot of calories, how do they do that?
And he said, well, they worked it off. And then he'd say, but they died before they were 50. And I'm like, okay.
They didn't work at all.
stay away from that.
Yeah. It's definitely not an every morning thing. I could say that I probably have had schmaltzbrot like two or three times in my entire life. But
good for you.
But so maybe I will discontinue that. I've never been tempted to drink a mug of hot lard. That'll be for another day. How about for you, Micah?
Oh,
charcuterie boards.
Very right for the pick.
Yeah.
Hey, any holiday, especially, or it doesn't have to be a holiday. We keep what some people might consider luxury cheese in our house year round. Aged cheddar, Parmesan, whatever. If you're at our house and you desire cheese and crackers, we don't always have the meat part of the board just because, you know, takes time, but yeah, it's a big thing in our house. I love charcuterie, and then yeah, you can mix and match the meats. You have something from Germany, something from Italy. You can have mousse. I mean, what's not to like?
Right.
Well, I guess I started with the cheese, which is the part you like the least. But
I love cheese. I just have to. Hard cheese is good. Soft cheese.
Yeah, I was gonna say good. Yeah. It's not always the same for everybody, but yeah. I mean, what's not to like? Yeah, it's good stuff. All right. Here we go, ripe for the picking or leave it on the tree. This is, somebody gave this one to me recently. Well, anyway, foreign films.
I'll take it, absolutely.
In original languages as well?
Yeah, as long as there are, subtitles.
Sure.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I definitely like foreign films. There's a lot of great ones that I've seen. If it's German, I enjoy just listening to the German so that I can try to follow along, but I still want subtitles on because it's typically spoken very quickly. Sure. So, I would way rather hear the actor's actual voice
as opposed to a dub over.
Yeah.
Apparently, there's who was telling me this? Well, anyway, if you're like in Germany. You can become like a fame or like anything like any other country. You can become a famous voice actor. Like if you voice act somebody like Leonardo DiCaprio and you're good at it, you become like a superstar being a voiceover actor, which just blows my mind.
Mm-hmm. Although AI is going to change that. I just read an article or watched a video or something about
it. It is really weird.
They have figured out AI has figured out how to take the voice and speak that in all those intonations and everything into a different dialect and remaster the person's face as they're saying the words.
Yeah.
AI is going to do crazy, crazy stuff.
The deep fakes are going to get crazy.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
It's a little controversial. Mm-hmm. It is right for the picking for me, but like with the caveat, it depends on the genre. Not every genre from every different culture is good, and I for me the one genre I struggle with the most in foreign films is comedy, because it's just like, you know, there's a point, and like obviously like this is a punchline. If you don't get it, what's the point of watching me and Dorothy go back and forth between us because we come from radically different cultures. She's British anyway, and it's hard for us to find comedy that meets in between, because British comedy is, well, anyway, it's British
comedy. It's an acquired taste.
Some of it's okay, but
some of it that's genius, right? John Cleese and
Ricky Gervais.
Yeah,
I think is again, but then there's some, and like, when we'll be around her family and they're watching British comedy and they're all cracking up, I'm like, I'm going to go do anything else. It's not for me. Anyway, although that wasn't foreign films, but you get what I mean.
All right. I don't know if this one will be controversial or not. We'll see. See if it elicits a little bit different opinion. But Ripe for the Picking or Leave It on the Tree, Hallmark greeting cards. So, like, getting a card on your birthday, getting a card or giving a card for someone's birthday or for an anniversary. Ripe for the Picking or Leave It on the Tree?
I like to receive. I'll Ripe for the Picking. I like to receive them.
Okay.
I'm not very good at giving them. Mm. And I, my mother is very good with cards. My father is good with cards. And they'll write notes in them and so forth. But my mother has very good taste in cards. I mean, we don't ever throw away in our entire family. My house, nobody ever throws away a card from Grandma Bodie because it's such beautiful artwork on the cover. She's very, very good at it. So we love to keep those and enjoy those, but I'm not very good at giving them myself.
Yeah, I'll throw out the controversial opinion that they're Leave It on the Tree for me. I do receive, my parents always send cards and my mother loves doing that. And I appreciate it because it comes from her. Mm-hmm. But my wife and I do not give each other cards under any circumstances whatsoever. So we're now well past Valentine's Day, but we're not Valentine's Day gift givers at all. We just think it's kind of, I don't know, for us it's just kind of silly. We scoff.
I can see that.
Yeah. We're kind of skeptical, a little jaded, you know. So Leave It on the Tree for us.
Sure.
Gen Xers that just,
It is Leave It on the Tree for me as well. I appreciate, for some of the same reasons, I'm a very bad card giver. Not that I can't pick one out. It's just the doing the thing itself. And I appreciate what goes behind receiving a card. Especially the thought if it's beautiful, things like that. Dorothy, I'm assuming, puts them somewhere. Because if it gets left out for too long, I'm probably going to throw it away. But for me, like, everything that's behind the physical card could all the same just be in a text for me. I'm very much millennial that way. And I don't want to be like it's a waste of paper. But
handwritten note is really, I do appreciate handwritten notes.
Yeah.
And I'll say this. And so this was one of the most remarkable things when talk about appreciating where you are and where you work. On my birthday, I received a handwritten card from President Egger. Mm-hmm. And it's the first time a boss, like, you know, your boss will send you like one of those printed ones and they might sign it or it might be like a stamp of their signature. But this was like personal handwritten birthday card from President Egger, and this was very early on into his presidency, and I was like, huh, look at that. And I don't have that card now either, but again, the thought behind it is just very special. I love what goes into it. Somebody's thinking about you and cares about you, and they've taken the time to do this, but the thing itself,
I don't have my most recent card from President Egger either because I put it in the seminary archives.
Oh, so, nice.
Which is where mine go.
Yours belongs in the archives. Yeah, mine, right. It's all right. Nobody will remember. Anyway, this is the last one. And for me, this is a big deal. Anyway, I shouldn't have said that. I don't want to influence your response. Right for the Picking, Leave It on the Tree, multicolored click pens.
I'll take it if it's a Bic.
Well, it has to be, anyway.
Yes.
Otherwise, it won't work.
Right.
Yeah.
Right. Those are great. I love those. I have them at home. I don't use them because my kids probably ran off with them. Sure. But yes. It's French.
Oh, look at that.
I saw you using one here recently, and this is probably why you picked this. I just think it is hilarious because, like, I mean, I had them like in the fifth grade or whatever, and they were really fun, you know, to like write in purple for like a couple weeks, and then I thought that whole fad had passed as like a a bad fad from the 1995s. And then I saw you writing this one, and I was like, where did you get that? It was like a Office blowback Depot. From the past.
But you kind of have to be a pen guy. Are you a pen guy?
Pens matter.
I can't just
pick up any pen and write with it. I'm very particular.
As long as ink comes out. And it's not a crazy color. It's black is usually what, or blue.
But how fine the tip is, again, the mm-hmm. quality of the ink, ballpoint pen, is it going to stick on the paper and skip, or is it going to just be smooth? Mm-hmm. All this really does matter to me. And I don't have one of these ones where it's like, you said purple. Don't insult me. It's not one of those ones with like 10 or 20 colors, because those are preposterous. No, you don't need one like that. It's the classic four. It has black, red, blue, and green. And some people will be offended by this, but they are my books that I purchased. I used to take notes in my books with pencil, but pencil fades and pencil rubs. So I do it in pen, and the four colors are particular. Like if it's just something that I'm reading, because you know, you'll be reading along and like it's like, this is a good point, I do green. If it's a brilliant point, I do blue. Or if I think it's like core part of the argument, I do blue, because at some point, you know, you're in graduate school, you're gonna have to go back and reread this and write a paper on it, and you have to be able to decipher, was this a note, or was this one that you should mention in your paper? And then if it's something I believe is controversial, I'll do red. I rarely use the black one because the ink is black. It doesn't stand out.
So it's not just that you disagree. Because I wanted to find all your red marks in your books, and then
it's not often. And it depends on the author. And I can't do it all the time, because sometimes when you're reading, I don't remember the Schleiermacher Systematics. Well, I didn't purchase that. It's the libraries. So I don't think.
We appreciate that.
Yeah, exactly.
If we find them, that's all written up with all the different colors, we know who did it.
It's definitely somebody else.
Wait, there's red? There's green? There's blue? Aha!
Micah.
The culprit. But yeah, it just helps me keep things organized. But it also, it's just convenient. Like most of the really good pens, they're just going to be black ink. Like when I see somebody who's written like a note in blue ink, I'm like, who are you? But anyway, I wish my handwriting was good enough to like warrant like a fountain pen. Dorothy, who again grew up in England where handwriting mm-hmm. was something different. She can do calligraphy mm-hmm. and it's beautiful. And so when I need something written, I say, hey, can you write this for me? Mm-hmm. But yeah, no, they're right for the picking. They're the most brilliant thing in the world. It's very classic. It's like white on top, blue on bottom. It's great.
Let us know in the comments what you think about these multicolored pens. I still think they're ridiculous.
If I know our listeners, they're on my side.
Yeah, they probably are. I know. All of the hot takes and cool things, that's definitely you.
Well, Dr. Bodhi, it's certainly been a pleasure to have you on finally. And I'm sure now that we're doing this more regularly, we'll probably send you an email. Or somebody will say, hey, can you have Dr. Bodhi come back on and talk about this thing? Because that's starting to come more and more. And we are reading the comments. We are starting to try to begin to cover some of these topics for you all. But that said, as we're getting ready to sign off for the day, if there was one piece of advice that you could give to anybody thinking about a career in church work, what would that one piece of advice be?
That's a great question. I don't know that I have one piece of advice beyond pray.
Sure.
I think you should come and visit. I think that's a great thing. That was a decisive for me. I don't think I mentioned this, but I visited Concordia Seminary a couple of times before when I was in high school. Mm. And then when I was in college, I came here. And that gave me, in my own mind, kind of a vision of what the place looked like, what the people here were like. And it oriented me so much better. And so after I did that, I was like, no, I'm going to go there. That's what I want. And so that really helped me to come here, get to talk to people. That was decisive. But I do want to emphasize prayer. I mean, we need to emphasize that as well. It's important.
Pray and visit. That's well said, well summarized.
Well,
love it.
I think those are great. And if you fill out an RFI and you want to have a conversation with us, we'll pray for you and we'll pray with you. And if you're college age or second career, we would love to host you for a personalized visit to come on campus and do exactly that, see what we're all about, experience it, sit in on classes. And if you or somebody you know is in high school, we're still taking registrations for our high school event, Vocatio, which begins June 24th and runs through July 1st. Free to attend. You just need to get here. And the registration is at csl.edu. If you click down the drop tab under admissions, you'll see visits, you'll see Boccaccio. I'm sure we can put a link in the description. Well, Dr. Bodhi, it has been a blast to finally have you on. Thank you. We were talking about history, and we were talking about how it can be joyful. You were my first history professor here in Intro to Historical Theology. I wanted to talk about that maybe sometime later. Landscape of History mm-hmm. is still a book. I haven't read it again, but I look at the picture all the time, which was the exercise we did. Took you with history at LCMS, and then I did all my other history classes at Westfield House because, mm-hmm. you know, different perspectives in that. But again, it's been a pleasure to have you on. Thank you for listening. Please make sure to like and subscribe if you appreciate the content. And if you're thinking about ministry as a career, don't think too long. It's risk-free. Fill out a request for information so we know who you are and where you are and how to contact you, and we'll reach out to you and begin that conversation. Maybe in conversation you realize it's not for you, but I have a feeling that if you're thinking about it a little bit, it's probably not just you saying that you should do it, but it's people around you, and more importantly, the Holy Spirit kind of trying to nudge you our way. So let us know who you are. And if you know somebody and you're looking at them, young or old, in your congregation or in the space around you, and you say to yourself, that person might be a good church worker, they might be a good pastor, good deaconess, don't think about that too long. Make sure to tell them, because you could be that brother or sister in Christ that is that extra encouragement that gets them to fill out the RFI, and they could be sitting on this couch and we ask you them what got into church work, and then they say, this person in this congregation told me I should do it, and they did it. And so you could be a part of their story of becoming a servant of Christ in this very specific way, in a professional way. Thank you all for listening, and we'll see you next time under the fig tree.